Welcome to Locus Focus. I'm Barbara Bernstein, your host for this weekly conversation about our place on the planet. This November, Portland voters will have an opportunity to vote on a complex measure that would amend the city charter in some drastic ways. The changes include ranked choice voting, expanding the city council to 12 members who would each represent one of four districts, and shifting from a commission form of government where the mayor and city commissioners directly manage the city's bureaus to a city council that sets policy rather than managing those bureaus, and a mayor elected citywide to run the city's day-to-day operations with the help of a professional city administrator. A few weeks ago, we heard arguments in favor of the ballot measure from Charter Commission member Candace Avalos. Today, we talk with an opponent to the measure, Stephen Moskowitz, who is one of three directors of a PAC that is formed to defeat the charter reform measure in November. Stevie, welcome to Locus Focus.
Thank you very much, Barbara. It's good to be with you.
And welcome back to Portland. I guess you've been here for 3 years, but we haven't seen each other in 25.
It's nice to see you, and it's good to be back in Portland.
And last time I saw you, you were a lawyer. I understand you're also a rabbi, right?
Well, yes. When I left Portland in 1999, it was to attend rabbinic school, which was 5 years. And then I took a position as a rabbi in a congregation in Southern California, in Long Beach, California. And I did that for 15 years. And then we came back to Portland 3 years ago.
How did your experience in Southern California inform your impressions about Portland city politics, which you were quite engaged with before you went down to California?
Well, it's a very different atmosphere down in Southern California. But, you know, I would come back, because we have family here, I would come back periodically to see family. And it did strike me that Portland was changing, and it wasn't changing, from my point of view, for the better. Things seemed to be getting a little rougher, a little more out of control. And actually, when I came back 3 years ago, one of our daughters said to me, who lives here, you know, Portland's become a really rough place, and you need to do something to fix it. And so I took that to heart, and so I started joining some volunteer cleanup groups and cleaning up the streets. And then I was elected to my neighborhood association board of directors, and then I became involved in this campaign.
I'm curious, how do you see that Portland was rougher 3 years ago? I mean, now it's really obvious that the city feels really transformed than it did. I would say that Portland's peak wonderful time was maybe 20 years ago to about 5 years ago before you came back. But I'm just curious about what you see and what you mean by rough.
Well, certainly what we're all seeing right now, which has to do with the tragedy of people living out on the streets, not having shelter, not having access to services that could help them make their lives whole again, the level of crime that's going on, and a seeming difficulty, not just in solving those problems, but in having a gracious kind of civil discourse to really try and solve those problems. It seems like things have become much more divided, separated, and partisan, which I think is part of an infection that's happened as a result of what's happening all around our country as a whole.
And that's for sure. I mean, that's one of the cliches now, in a way, is that the country is really so seriously divided, hasn't been this divided since the Civil War. I wonder how much of that problem can be placed on our form of government. Even before you left Portland, there's been complaints about the commission form of government that we've had for, what, like now 90 years or something. And I wonder how much of the problem is that, and then where else do you see that some of the problems are derived from?
Well, you know, the form of government that we currently have, the commission form of government, is one that no other city has. But at one point, it was considered a progressive move. And it was one that was started in Galveston, Texas, I believe it was 1903 or 1904. And it was in response to a hurricane that happened. And the mayor and the city council there at the time said, we need to respond to this crisis that's happening in our city. And to do that, we need to all focus on addressing this immediate crisis. And so they took upon themselves the actual direction of city departments so they could deal with this crisis. And that was seen as progressive at the time, because up until then, city councils across the country, including in Texas, were rife with corruption and favoritism and so forth. And so this was seen as a progressive move to get beyond that corrupt set of practices and for these elected officials to be held accountable for directly dealing with the problems in their streets. I remember former mayor Bud Clark, for whom I worked for 4 years, would say, you know, the commission form of government is a good form of government when you know what the hurricane is, when you can all agree as elected officials on what's the crisis that we need to address, and we have some consensus among us about what we need to do. But I think over the years what's happened is we have, because of the nature of politics perhaps, people run for office and they become primarily concerned not only with problems that citizens face, but also with their own reelection. And so they are able to use departments and bureaus to promote their own personal political agenda, rather than achieving some consensus among themselves about what needs to be done for the city as a whole. When Bud Clark was mayor, he would hold goal-setting sessions among members of the city council so they'd all agree and have a sense of what's the strategic goals that we want to achieve as a collective group, and let's then distribute among ourselves some responsibilities for achieving those. And then we seem to have lost that capacity to achieve a level of consensus at the political level. And so I think services have begun to decline, and there doesn't seem to be as much agreement about collectively how to address these at that political level.
Well, it seems to me that we're seeing a lot of cases where the different bureaus are at odds with each other. One that comes to mind, which is one of the more recent cataclysms, particularly relating to climate change, is the fight between the Bureau of Environmental Services and the parks over who's going to be planting trees. And as a result of that, it appears to me that we're planting fewer trees and we're taking out more trees. And it's the worst thing to do when we're dealing with a climate crisis. And I wonder if you see that that's an example of this dysfunction of the commission form of government that we have.
I think it's both a great example and a very sad and tragic example. Because as you point out, during this elevation in the crisis of climate, having trees is something that is so fundamental to achieving a lowering a level of our heat. And the fact that our tree canopy in Portland is actually decreasing at a time when it should be increasing is the wrong direction to be going in. And as you pointed out, there are two different bureaus within the city who are handled by two different city commissioners, and they seem to be having some kind of a squabble between them as to either jurisdiction over this issue of planting trees or the importance of planting trees. And so fewer trees are being planted, and the real tragedy is that those who are suffering the most from that loss of canopy and the increase in heat are people in lower income neighborhoods who have less options for how to deal with the increase in heat.
Well, another example that I see has to do with having people in charge of the commission, of the bureaus, basically the particular commissioner, who perhaps don't really have the skills and the knowledge to be running these bureaus. And it goes all the way back to the days when Eric Sten, who was a great guy and had great politics, I don't think he knew much about water, and he was in charge of the Water Bureau. And there was all kinds of crises that happened around not billing people and all kinds of things that happened, which I think really set back the Portland Bureau, Water Bureau for years. I'm not sure they've quite recovered from that kind of disaster. And I will not name names currently, but I think that there's a couple commissioners who are in charge of bureaus where I really don't think they know what they're doing. So it seems to exacerbate the kinds of problems. So do you think that there's enough people now who think that the commission form of government doesn't work, that maybe that's a change that could actually happen?
Well, even before I left Portland, I was advocating for a change in the commission form of government because it was clear that people who were elected to positions of political leadership didn't necessarily have the technical skills or even sometimes the executive skills to be able to run these very technical departments. And so, yes, I think there has been a consensus about the need to change the commission form of government to one where we have elected leaders whose primary purpose is what we'll call legislative, to set policy, to oversee the strategic direction of the city, and then to delegate the actual technical implementation of that initially to, say, a city manager, and then to professionals who have professional backgrounds in areas of, say, water and engineering and streets and so forth. So that's why it was actually, for me personally, kind of a surprise. I was glad when the Charter Commission was going to be founded in 2020. I said, well, this is great. Now we'll have an opportunity to achieve what I think is a citywide consensus about changing the commission form of government to something else. And I was very shocked and surprised when the result was something that was went far beyond that. It was something much more complex and confusing that went far, far beyond what I thought was the community consensus about what was needed at this time.
Well, I think that there's some other community consensuses that, though, that are in the proposals to change the city charter. And one of them, I think, is, well, maybe not from everybody, but a lot of people across the city are in agreement that the city council is too heavily represents the southwest part of Portland and has traditionally been basically white guys. Now, that's changed in the last council. This was the first council where we actually have a majority of people of color. But it's a long time coming, and it doesn't feel like it's something that is really instilled in the Portland ethic yet, and that part of the problem, I know that the people on the Charter Commission believe this, but I've talked to other people too who believe that a lot of the problem of why the Portland City Council is so unrepresentative of the people of Portland has to do with that there's only five of them, or four of them, plus the mayor, and that they also are elected citywide. And so it allows concentrations of campaign money to go to certain candidates who have better connections to money, and so we still have the same usual suspects often on city council.
Well, as you mentioned, I think the fact that the current city council that we have is a demonstration of some great progress that the city has made. And we have a black woman, we have a black man, we have a Hispanic woman, we have a gay man, and then we have
a straight
white man. So this is a great statement about the progress that the city has made. And I think expanding opportunities for both civic engagement and activism and access to positions of political power is a great thing. And in fact, I'm supportive of the idea of having district-wide representation as opposed to all citywide. I think the particular proposal that this commission has come up with is both too radical and too confusing, and actually is too undemocratic.
Well, we'll talk a little bit more about that in a moment, but first okay. I want to let you know that you're listening to Locus Focus on KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Oregon, Seattle stations KPFG, LPFM, KODX, LPFM, KMUN and KCBB in Astoria, Oregon, KCEI in Taos, New Mexico, Radio Free Moscow in Idaho, and Radio Tacoma. And today we're talking with Stephen Moskowitz, who's one of three directors of a PAC that has formed to defeat the charter reform measure that's going to be on the November ballot. Sort of a disclosure. Before I did the show with Candace Avalos a few weeks ago, who was talking in support of the charter reforms, I was very skeptical about the proposals. I sort of agreed with you that there were too many things that seemed to be conflicting or hard to understand, and I had lots and lots of questions. It helped me to read the report or parts of the report to get a better understanding, and then also Candace explained it in a way that also started to make sense to me. So I kind of want to go through all the issues that you have with it and sort of dissect them, and then maybe look at the other side of why the proponents of the city charter changes have decided to go the route that they're going. It seems like everybody that I know of is in support of changing from a commission government to the government you described. There's a difference. One of the things that sort of bothered me in the beginning was hearing the term city manager, because I grew up in a small city in New England. It was very corrupt. It was a democratic city, but it was kind of like the old machine democratic city, and it had a weak city council, a perilous mayor and a very strong city manager who I felt, seemed to me, ran the city and in ways that weren't of interest to everybody. So I grew up with a kind of negative attitude towards city managers. I've also experienced a couple other cities that I thought had very strong and not particularly together city managers. But it was explained to me that the plans in the Charter Commission are not for a manager but for an administrator, and the difference being that the administrator is beholden to the mayor and to the council, and is not the where the power all winds up residing, as it did in Oakland before Jerry Brown changed their city government a number of years ago. So you use the term city manager, but I'm wondering if you are using that interchangeably with administrator.
I'm being kind of generic with the notion of having a chief executive, let's say, who's responsible directly for overseeing all of the city bureaus and departments, as opposed to that being held by the people who are sitting on the city council.
So basically saying somebody who actually has the managerial skills to do this. Because it seems to me another very important part is how that city administrator is appointed and who they're beholden to. Because that's where I could see, like in the city of Richmond, California, it seemed like the city manager had an awful lot of power, and the mayor basically had a bully pulpit, and that was it. So that's not the kind of city manager relationship you're seeing, is it?
Well, no, we have one. What's been proposed, the idea is that the mayor would have the capacity to hire someone. The mayor would have the capacity to fire that person upon notifying the city council of doing so. And I believe the city council would have a final approval on the hiring of that person. So
that's all in agreement. Okay. So far you're in agreement with the charter changes.
Yeah, that part, I think, as I said, that part, I think there's a wide consensus about the need to move in that direction.
So let's get to district elections, which is also sounds like, in theory, you support the same concept that is in the proposed changes. I mean, there's some big changes. I know there's some big differences in the details, but you see that district elections makes more sense than citywide elections.
Yeah, I'd be in favor of having district elections. I think I would have a difference of opinion about the number of representatives you have from each district and perhaps how many districts there ought to be, because having four districts really divides that up into groups of about 160,000 people or so, and I think I might want to divide that up into something even smaller population size.
I sort of had the same feeling at first. I thought that seemed to be too, I couldn't even figure out what the districts would be and how they'd be representative. Now, Candace explained about how when you have and their studies, and actually I looked at one of the places, one of their sources for where they drew their wisdom about these decisions. But she said that if the districts are too small, they actually become these little fiefdoms, which is not representative. And having one person represent a smaller district is not going to get the kind of diversity on city council that having four districts with three representatives in each district. So I wonder what your response to that would be.
Yeah, you know, let's talk about the issue of diversity, because I think that that's a key point that the commission members are making. And I think having expanding the opportunities for a diverse group of people to have access to power and to have access to political powers is really important. However, the promise that's behind this current proposal is not based on any data or any evidence. It's based on some theory, but it's never been demonstrated anywheres in the United States. The idea of having multi-membered districts that are elected the way this commission proposal wants to have them elected. So, in fact, most jurisdictions that have had the kind of multi-member districts that the commission is proposing have backed away from it, particularly because it produced the opposite of what the commission has promised. It, in fact, diluted minority representation.
So there's this guy I was reading about last night, Moon Duchin, who's with the Tufts MGGG redistributing lab. So he is a theoretician, but I think that they've run a lot of models, and also in the article that I was reading, they mentioned a number of communities around the country that actually have multi-member districts. So it's not, I don't think they've all failed, according to him. But what he says, multi-member districts elected proportionally make it possible for multiple groups to be represented in a single district. In contrast, a single councillor can never represent the full diverse spectrum of political views represented among their constituents. And so the Charter Commission won't draw the districts themselves, but will include some guidelines and a process for a different body, like a citizen committee, to draw the districts moving forward. So I'm just wondering what your thoughts are on that.
Well, again, it's based on theory, but let's look at something that's been an actual experiment in multi-member districts, and that's the city of Baltimore. So the city of Baltimore had multi-member districts. It had six districts with three people from each district, so it had 18 people sitting on a city council. And in 2002, the voters of Baltimore voted to repeal that, and then to switch instead to have, I believe it's eight districts with one person representing each district. And what they found was they actually got a more diverse, a younger set of people sitting on city council than they did with six districts and three people from each district, where not only was the composition of the city council not as good as once they rejected that and repealed that, but they also got business done more, and the city improved, and there was more hopefulness. So that's an actual laboratory experiment on the ground, in which demonstrates that what the current commission proposal is doing is something that failed.
I don't have in front of me like the other cities that he mentions that actually are using multi-member districts. But it seemed that Baltimore is a city that has an awful lot of problems, and I'm happy to hear that their current city council is working better than it was in the days of The Wire, that the show The Wire represented, where you saw a really dysfunctional city. But the other thing, 18-member city council, I mean, a lot of us, when we were hearing about this proposal, thought 12 members is a very large city council. I mean, 18 sounds really unwieldy, and in fact, Candace said that, I mean, 12 to her seemed a little bit large, too, and it was about as large as they wanted to go. So I think you do have diminishing returns when your city council gets a little too big.
Well, I think in part that's why Baltimore ended up rejecting having 18 people sitting on the city council and rejected having three people from six districts being elected. And while I might be in favor of having district elections, I would want one person from each district being elected because, you know, when you combine the multi-member districts, which is what's being proposed here, four districts and three people representing each district, when you combine that with the form of voting that they're advocating, what's called a form of ranked choice voting, then in their proposal, it would only take 25% of a district's vote to elect someone to city council. So someone would be elected with 25% of the vote. I think that has a lot of problems built into it too, to the extent to which both what kind of a mandate does that person really bring to city council, and once that person is elected, how hard it's going to be to unelect that person if all they need is to regain 25% of the vote.
But one of the rationales, I think, for the way that they decided to divide up districts has to do with the fact that there is not a neighborhood in Portland or even a few neighborhoods in Portland where there's a high enough concentration of people of color that they could actually elect a representative in district-wide elections. And so the way that their plan was to be able to find ways to give that support. And in fact, since there's no neighborhood, there was no way they could draw a district where there'd be more than 30% of the voters would be people of color. They, in a way, having a 25% voting victory would guarantee representation. This is the logic that they're using. So I just wonder, does that make sense to you, or do you still feel strongly that having somebody elected with 25% of the vote is just not fair?
Well, first of all, there's no guarantee that what the commission has as a desired outcome, namely increased minority representation, is going to happen as a result of this proposal. It's based on some theory, but there's no evidence that's what would happen. All we know for sure is that all it takes under their proposal to get elected to city council would be to get 25% of the vote. That opens up possibilities for people getting elected that wouldn't necessarily meet the desired outcome of what the commission has in mind.
Now, what's your sense about ranked choice voting? Is that something you support?
Well, first of all, there's many different types of ranked choice voting. And in fact, the commission's proposal has two different types of ranked choice voting that would operate under their proposal. One is called instant runoff. And that instant runoff ranked choice voting is what's used in many cases. It's been used most recently in the state of Alaska in their recent election. Instant runoff ranked choice voting is what's used when many candidates are running for one seat. And the way that works is people have a ballot and they're able to prioritize rank their favorite choices among, let's say, a list of 10 people. That this A is their first choice, B is their second, C is their third, so forth and so on. And then once an election happens, the votes are counted. If no one reaches 50% plus one of the vote, then the candidate with the fewest number of votes is eliminated. And anyone who voted as, well, that candidate was my first choice, then their second place candidates are then counted, or their vote is then allocated to their second choice candidate. And then you go through another calculation until finally someone comes up with 50%. And so it's called instant runoff because the way we currently do things is we have a primary in May with, let's say, 10 people running. If no one gets 50% plus one of the vote, then we have to have a runoff against the top two winners. Instant runoff is a way for a computer, in a sense, to eliminate the need for having that runoff. It calculates among the top tiers until someone gets 50% plus one of the vote. That's an interesting possibility, but that is the method that the commission has recommended for the mayor and for the city auditor, both of whom are running citywide. Okay. But that's not the method by which city councilors would be elected. City councilors would be elected by a different type of ranked choice voting called a single transferable vote, a ranked choice voting. And the way that works is you have, let's say, 10 candidates, or actually 10 candidates running. Once again, you get to choose, this is my first favorite, this is my second, this is my third, fourth, fifth, sixth, seventh, eighth, ninth, tenth, okay? And then there is a threshold of what percentage of votes someone needs to get in order to win. And in the model that the commission has chosen, in a three-member race in a district, the percentage is 25% plus one of the vote. That's what it takes to get elected. And an election happens, and if someone gets 25% plus one of the vote, they get elected. However, if no one reaches that threshold, then unlike with the instant runoff, where you eliminate the lowest candidate and then you start reallocating votes. In this case, if someone reaches 25%, then that person and gets more votes than those additional votes are called surplus votes, and they don't get counted towards that candidate because they've already reached the number of votes they need to have in order to win. And so those votes are now reallocated to other candidates in order to get two more people elected out of that district. So this is a very different model than the, what's called the instant runoff, which people are more, probably more familiar with. And it's designed to reallocate someone that you voted for, but they've already got enough votes, so now your vote's not going to go to that person. Now they're going to look at what your second favorite candidate was and allocate votes towards that. You know, typically, we have had about 10 people running for any seat when it comes up for election in Portland. So in a district where you have 3 people running, it's likely that you'll have 10 people, you could have 30 people running for that in that district, which means that you could be ranking 30 people. If you've got 30 people with the possibility for 30 different rankings that you'll want to go through, then you'll have a ballot with 900 bubbles on it. So that's part of the concern is now you'll need to know not just 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 people to understand their qualifications. You'll need to understand about 30 different people in order to be able to intelligently rank among them.
I'm a little confused. I was actually under the impression that with the ranked choice voting for council members that there's a limit. It wasn't going to be everybody that was running that you'd have ranked them. You'd just be ranking like your top 4 or 5.
No, the commission proposal says you can rank as many as you want. And so if you have 30 people running for those 3 seats, then you have the capacity under their proposal to rank 30 people. So you'd have 30, you could choose, this is my first and go all the way through, this is my 30th choice. In which case, if you've got 30 times 30, you've got 900 bubbles on a ballot.
Well, you're listening to Locus Focus on Cape Breton Radio in Portland, Oregon, Seattle stations KBFG, LPFM, and KODX, LPFM, KMUN, and KCBB in Astoria, Oregon, KCEI in Taos, New Mexico, Radio Free Moscow in Idaho, and Radio Tacoma. And today we're talking with Stephen Moskowitz, one of 3 directors of a PAC that's formed to defeat the charter reform measure that's going to be on the November ballot here in Portland. Another issue that I've heard concern about, and this is like the biggest, well, Stephen, it's like one of the biggest ones, is that there's too many things on one ballot. And in fact, the Portland Business Alliance tried to derail the ballot measure by claiming that, and yet it seems, I guess the city attorney has said that the ballot measure meets muster and that it can be all these different issues on the same ballot. But do you have concerns about all these different issues being on this one ballot?
Well, I think it's a very complex proposal, and I think it's a very confusing proposal. And in fact, Judge Bouchon, who is the judge who presided over the case that you just mentioned that was brought by the Portland Business Alliance, challenging what's known as the Oregon Constitution requirement that a ballot measure cover just a single subject, Judge Bouchon said, constitutionally, I find that this does cover just one subject, as broad as that might be, having to do with the structure of city government. But even Judge Bouchon said, I have to admit, I've read this proposal and I find it pretty confusing. Now, the fact that a measure is complex and confusing does not constitutionally prohibit it from being on the ballot. It just makes for a measure that's complex and confusing.
Because I was very confused, I have to admit, when I first heard about it. It made a difference to read it. And of course, our concern as people who want to get as wide of voter participation as possible, if people are confused, they're going to be less likely to vote for it. I think that the Charter Commission is trying to do as best they can to educate voters about what their plan is and why they think this would be the way to do it. What is some of your concerns about the confusion level that this could generate?
Well, here's one which I just stumbled across when I was rereading the proposal. They suggest that, or their recommendation is that those districts that have historically low voter turnout should have their districts be voted on during what's called the general election, the same time when the mayor is running, because it's thought that would encourage higher voter turnout, and that those the other districts that have had higher voter turnout would have their representatives elected during the off years, which is, and the auditor would also be elected during that time. So I read that and I thought, well, if that's the rationale for when these two districts should have their elections, namely during the general runoff, a general election, because that's draws more voters. Well, what happens after a series of election cycles? Those two districts that were historically low voter turnout now, because of this manipulation, have higher voter turnout than the other two. Does that mean there should now be a correction and the other twos? Well, that would be very complicated if you've already got a cycle set in. So that was very confusing to me, and I still don't know how that would work out.
Now, on the other hand, one of the things they're going to do is do away with the primary, so that people will, this will all happen on the general election, or the, well, they're all general elections, but the ones that are on the leap years as opposed to the ones that are on the just even years but not leap years. What's your sense about how that would work out?
Well, that's what I'm saying. Yes, the idea behind ranked choice voting is to do away with primaries. But that's the instant runoff form of ranked choice voting, which is not what they're proposing to deal with the election of councilors. And again, I remain very confused about how you make these adjustments without confusing all these election cycles if the formerly low voter turnout two districts now have higher voter turnout because of how you've manipulated the voting cycles, and now the other two are having low voter turnout. Should you now switch them? But I don't see how you could do that.
Yeah, I understand that, but my question is about how do you feel about doing away with the primary, which has been a very key part of Oregon elections?
Well, yes, it's a part of many jurisdictions. I'm interested in the reason for having a primary is that you have a lot of people running, and then it's a way to begin to winnow out who should have either someone wins outright or someone doesn't win outright. You've now winnowed it down to two people who are going to have a runoff in the fall. And in some ways, there's something to be said for that. There's like, because you want to have further discussion. It allows you to have further debate. We had, for example, this last May, we had a city council race with a lot of people running, and no one got the 50% plus one. And so now in November, we're going to have a runoff between two people. And there's something positive about that because it extends the debate between these candidates. It doesn't end the debate in May. It allows for further debate and a sharpening of the issues. So there's something to be said for having a primary and then a general election.
I think one of the arguments against the primary, though, is that it precludes low-income candidates because it costs a lot of money to run a campaign. And so it's like the double amount of money to campaign in May and then have to do it again in November.
Well, if you look at who has run in some of these primaries, there are a lot of low-income people who have run. But the other wonderful thing about Portland is that we have this matching fund, campaign fund that the city of Portland provides, which is another issue, though, to think about if you're going to have 30 people in just potentially one district. If you multiply that every election cycle by two districts running, 60 people running, and all those 60 people now having the option to ask for public funds to fund their campaigns, that's going to add up to a lot of money.
Well, it'd be nice, actually. My personal opinion would be to really limit campaign advertising on television, and that you would have less money. You'd divvy it up equally, be less money, and that's all that you could spend for your campaign.
Well, you know, the whole issue of money, not just in campaigns, but the whole issue of the amount of money that this proposal is going to cost is really astronomical. If this proposal passes, what will result will be a massive transfer of money, of wealth, from neighborhoods into City Hall. And the proposal itself says that this will result in about $43.8 million, which would otherwise go towards direct services to people in the neighborhoods. $43.8 million of the first 3 years of this proposal is going to be spent on City Hall, rather than City Hall spending $43 million on services for the people in the neighborhoods. That to me is a terrible outcome.
Well, you're listening to Locus Focus on KBRU Community Radio in Portland, Oregon, Seattle stations KPFG, LPFM, and KODX, LPFM, KMUN and KCBB in Astoria, Oregon, KCEI in Taos, New Mexico, Radio Free Moscow in Idaho, and Radio Tacoma. And today we're talking with Stephen Moskowitz, one of three directors of a PAC that's formed to defeat the charter reform measure that's going to be on the ballot in November. Well, Steve, one thing that I found kind of interesting is I was looking at who's supporting this charter amendment as opposed to who is opposing it. And the only people I've seen who are really vocally opposed to it are white men. And lots of community of color, people, you know, different organizations, a lot of environmental organizations, Portland Audubon for that matter, are pretty much in support of the measure and doing the best they can to educate people. So I just wonder, why is it that most of the opposition to it is coming from white guys?
So first of all, just within the steering committee of the Political Action Committee Partnership for Common Sense Government that is leading a campaign to vote no on this measure, just within this small steering committee, there are several people in particular who might take great offense with what you just said. That includes Maria Rojo DeStefi, who is a former Multnomah County Commissioner, Chip Lazenby, who is African-American man who was former legal counsel to former Governor John Kitzhaber, Alyssa Piska, who recently ran for Metro President. And beyond the immediate steering committee of this group, within the wider coalition that we're a part of to oppose this measure, there are people who would personally find that very offensive, including James Posey, the founder of the National Coalition of Minority Contractors, City Commissioner Mingus Maps, members of his Ulysses PAC, including Portland Trailblazer basketball player Terry Porter, and many others. So I find it offensive.
Well, actually, the people who we should be going after is the media, because I've just made that statement based on who I've seen quoted in a number of different articles that I've read. And it's basically been you and... I'm trying to think of...
Well, that's okay. I understand what you're saying.
Yeah, I mean...
So there are three of us. Yeah. So when you found...
But there's also somebody else who worked with you in Bud Clark's office.
Yes, Chuck Duffy.
Right. And it sort of seems like it's been the same few players that get quoted all the time. Well, so that's what gave me the impression that this is a bunch of white guys.
So that's because when you create a nonprofit political action committee, you have to designate someone to be the director on a form that you fill out with the Secretary of State. And so Chuck Duffy and I are friends. We both worked in Bud Clark's office. We signed on to start this as directors, and we were joined by Vadim Mazursky, who recently ran for city council. But it quickly grew beyond that. Now, the fact that members of the press keep going back to certain people for quotes is a lack of curiosity and perhaps poor reporting on their part. But the group itself and the coalition beyond is expanding, and I think it's going to demonstrate. We'll have our campaign kickoff September 6th, and I think people will see that this is something that is grown far beyond and is far more diverse than some of those newspaper articles are indicating.
Well, I appreciate that. I mean, and I think that that's important for your cause that word gets out, because I'm probably not the only person who's sort of seeing it this way, because this is the way it's being presented in the media. I will say, though, I was impressed by who I saw on the Charter Commission, that I thought was a very interesting group of people. And it actually had quite a broad spectrum of political opinions as well as other issues and identities. And I wonder how your response to that kind of diversity, because I think that it's probably a far cry from earlier charter commissions and the old days of Portland when it was basically just a bunch of white guys who were making dealings in back rooms. So do you think that that's an important step, that in fact the Charter Commission does represent so much diversity?
Look, I think it's great to have diversity. All I'm looking at and evaluating is the proposal that came out of it. And I think it's a proposal that's going to do more harm than good. I think it's a proposal that's going to create a more undemocratic city council. I think it's a proposal that's going to expend an enormous amount of money just on additional number of city councilors, and it's going to take away money that should be spent on creating public safety, on dealing with the homeless crisis, on cleaning up our streets. Let me just give you a couple of examples. Our city is filthy. It's full of trash. And if we could take a basic large yard can dumpster, 30-yard dumpster, costs about $600 to rent for 10 days. For about $500,000, we could have six of those large dumpsters in every square mile of Portland for 10 days, and we could launch a massive cleanup of the city. Or let me give you another example. We're facing a terrible moral crisis of having people living out on the streets in need of shelter and a need of services that could help them make their lives whole once again. There's one project called Helping Hands, which has a facility at Bybee Lakes, and it costs them about $24 a day to house someone, to provide them food, laundry, and all the medical services, addiction treatment services, and mental health treatment services that they would need, $24 a day. So for about $1.2 million, you could fill that place up to capacity, which is about 320 beds. You could fill that place up to capacity, 320 people for 6 months, shelter, food, taking care of their basic medical needs, their addiction needs, their mental health needs. That, to me, is a much better use of $1.2 million than any of that $43 million that will be spent on the salaries, PERS benefits, health insurance, office supplies, staffing for 12 city councilors.
Well, I could also kind of counter that with another argument. The group that basically formed last year to spend a lot of money raising criticism of Portland City Council, and I'm not sure how many millions of dollars that they spent basically trashing Joanne Hardesty in particular and some other city council people. And I kept thinking about, you know, they complain about homelessness, and yet instead of putting money into just these ads that they did, they could have put a lot of money into really addressing homelessness. The closest homeless shelter to where I live in Selwood was right across from Oaks Bottom, the north parking lot, and it served women and children. And it closed, I understand, recently. And it's a heartbreak, and you can see the difference, and you can see that now there's like major homeless encampments across the street right at the edge of Oaks Bottom. So I think that there's a lot of looking at where this money can be spent, and unfortunately I think a lot of this money is being spent on very strange kinds of advertising to trash politicians as opposed to maybe step in and do what the politicians aren't doing.
Well, great. Then let's start with this proposal. Instead of spending $43.8 million over 3 years on people sitting in City Hall, let's send that money out into the neighborhoods to create safer neighborhoods, to create cleaner neighborhoods, and to get people living off the streets into places where they can receive the kind of care and treatment that will help them restore them to wholeness. You know, I'm angry, Barbara. I'm angry. And what makes me angry is that gun violence in our city has increased 240% over 3 years. Homicides have increased 144% over 3 years. I'm angry that doctors and nurses are fearful of going to work at Emmanuel Hospital. I'm angry, Barbara, that a 10-year-old girl has to run through gunfire in a park to safety in her mother's arms. I'm angry that there are thousands of people living out on the streets without shelter, needing basic services to restore them to wholeness. I'm angry, Barbara, that this city that's once so beautiful and pristine has become filthy, a dump. I'm angry about that. I'll tell you one thing I'm not so angry about. I'm not so angry that we don't have 12 city councilors instead of the 4 that we have now. And I'd much rather spend $43.8 million making our city safer, cleaner, and restoring people to health and well-being than on 12 city councilors.
Though I talk to a lot of people who are pretty angry at who's on city council right now. I think I get a pretty strong consensus. People feel like the current city council was not up to the job of running the city. I don't know that 12 people would be any better. I mean, I think it really comes down to who the people are who get elected and creating a mechanism for them, for the right people to get elected. And I'm not sure, I'm not convinced that this Charter Commission change that's proposed is going to address that issue. But it seems like that's something we really need to be looking at in the city, is why can't we get good candidates to run and have and get them the support they need for voters to understand what they represent. But in the meantime, I do feel like we've got majority of council seems to me is just kind of out to lunch as far as really trying to figure out how to address these problems and coming up with very tiny solutions that just are, you know, just kind of fall into this abyss and don't go anywhere because they're just not enough and there's no vision.
Barbara, that's a much better issue for us to be dealing with than to be spending $43.8 million on what Baltimore has shown to be a failed experiment.
Though I did find when I was talking with Candace a few weeks ago that it's interesting to look at solutions or suggestions of solutions that have not been tried, that are not the way that we always do things. And I see that you disagree that this would work, but I am intrigued by really looking at ideas that really challenge the way we've always done things and challenge the way we always think about things. And maybe do you have another idea that might be as much of a challenge and maybe more practical in your mind than what this change, the proposed change is?
Well, I'm all for changing to some kind of administrative form of government where we've got city councilors who are primarily overseeing policy and the strategic direction of the city, with implementation of that strategy being handled by professionals. I'm all for district elections. I might have more districts than what they propose, but I'd only have single people representing each district so that you've got someone sitting on city council who's been elected by 50% plus one of the vote rather than 25% of the vote. But to get to those new ideas and implement them, the first thing we need to do is to defeat this current measure, which is only going to make things worse. Then we can have a better measure on a ballot in next May that would be much more sensible and much more effective.
Now, is that actually, because I've heard people saying if this thing goes down, then it's another 10 years before we even can look at it again. So is it possible to get another measure?
Absolutely. And in fact, Commissioner Mingus-Mapps has already pledged to bring something to the ballot next May.
Well, Stephen, it's been very interesting talking to you and very interesting to hear your perspective. So thanks so much for being on Locus Focus.
Thank you so much for having me, Barbara.
We've been talking with Portland attorney Stephen Moskowitz, and you've been listening to Locus Focus on KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Oregon, Seattle stations KBFG up here from KODX up FM, KMUN and KCBB in Astoria, Oregon, KCI in Taos, New Mexico, Radio Free Moscow in Idaho, and Radio Tacoma. If you're just tuning in and you'd like to hear what you missed or you want your friends or family to hear this show, you can listen to a podcast on our website, kboo.fm/locus-focus. To hear previous episodes of this show or any of our KBOO Public Affairs programming, go to kboo.fm or listen on iTunes, Google Play, or wherever you get your podcasts. I want to give special thanks to the KBOO staff who are doing an incredible job of not only keeping KBOO in the air, but helping all us volunteers make the best radio possible during this pandemic. And you can help us if you're able by becoming a member of KBOO or renewing your membership if you're already a member. We're independent, community-supported, volunteer-powered radio. Go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Or please support the community station you're listening to right now. Thanks for supporting community-powered radio. I'm Barbara Bernstein. My engineer is Ray Bodwell. Next week, we'll be broadcasting an interview I did with Riley Black, author of Last Days of the Dinosaurs. We'll go out with music by Laura Nero. Thanks for listening. Stay safe, get your COVID shots, and remember to socially distance and wear a mask when necessary.